Министерство образования Красноярского края разослало учебного процесса военное время.
Наши армия и флот должны обладать самым современным наращиванием объемов производства военной продукции.
Ужас и холод апокалипсиса.
Это уже видно невооруженным глазом всего человечества. Бездну окончания истории.
School administrators in the Siberian city of Krasnoyarsk have been given instructions on how to operate in wartime conditions, under mass mobilization, and during martial law. At a highly publicized meeting with military officials and defense contractors in Sochi last week, Vladimir Putin instructed large corporations to be prepared to increase their production of military goods. At the same meeting, Putin extended Russia's 19 trillion ruble armaments program through 2027. And Patriarch Kirill recently warned that the apocalypse is already visible to the naked eye, and the world risks slipping into the abyss at the end of history. We've become pretty accustomed to bellicose rhetoric from the Kremlin in recent years, but in the past week, it appears to have been dialed up to 11. So what exactly is going on? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vorty, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
So, with all the bellicose rhetoric coming out of Moscow since the 2014 annexation of Crimea, Russia's intervention in the Donbass, and the ensuing confrontation with the West, none of these things that I mentioned in the intro are particularly surprising when considered individually. Not the instructions to Krasnoyarsk schools about wartime conditions, not the armaments program, and not even Kirill's remarks about the apocalypse. But when things like this come in rapid succession, when they come as Putin's preparing to launch his presidential campaign, and when they come from a Kremlin that is very skilled and very careful about messaging, they appear to point to something. Mark, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think there's two interconnected points here. I mean, as you say, each of the individual ones one can actually discount quite easily. I mean, the Krasnoyarsk school thing, it wasn't as if it was a national instruction. It was retrospectively sort of blessed by the centre, shall we say. But again, I think what this speaks to is exactly what we've talked about in the past, this element of Putinism from below, that initiative from local authorities because they think that is what they think believe
the
Moscow wants. Exactly. And to an extent, I mean, Kirill, you know, with the greatest of respect for his religious authority, is in many ways, you know, one of the fools in Tsar Vladimir's court. You know, he comes up with this kind of bizarreness in between blessing satellites and tanks and such like. And likewise, if one actually looks at that issue of the arms procurement program being pushed back to 2027, I mean, what that reflects is failure, not expansion. Mm-hmm. It's actually because it's increasingly obvious that they're not going to be hitting their original targets.
What jumped out at me about that was how much this was publicized, because this is not a new armaments program. It's an old armaments program. They talked about increasing the funding toward extending it. And yes, it was a meeting. We're talking about failures as much as successes. But the fact that that meeting and the rhetoric of that meeting was publicized so extensively.
Well, precisely. So this is the second thing. You know, we have Putinism from below, but the point is exactly they have to be reflecting something. They have to be responding to something. And that is, I think, the overarching narrative, which is we're heading back, well, not as if we ever really left, but a reaffirmation of Fortress Russia. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, we see it with a whole variety of other indicators. I mean, I was particularly struck with the media issue. Now, okay, I mean, to an extent, their media controls on foreign outlets is a response to and a reflection of the American campaign. But they've taken it beyond that.
Yes.
With this, you know, additional attempt to basically sort of squeeze foreign newspapers out of the sort of access and that kind of thing. And I think what it is clear is that we are seeing an element of a plan, I don't know if it's B or C, but the Russian management, I think, of the presidential election. Mm. You know, they had hoped originally that it would be a buoyant, enthusiastic, positive coronation. Then they went for let's just try and sort of sex it up a bit with some new candidates, and clearly they are trying that. But I think there's also an element of, well, okay, what positive message can we offer? And I think The answer is they haven't really got a positive message except to say to Russians, the world is a scary, scary place. Everybody hates you. Everybody wants a piece of your natural resources. Everybody disdains your civilizational behavior. And this is why particularly we're seeing the church once again being shuffled to the front of the pack. This is not the time for any kind of change. This is the time when you need your iconic defender, and that is, of course, never mind Tsar, but Saint Vladimir, you know, the gatherer of the Russian lands. It's not a particularly innovative, impressive, positive message, but it's nonetheless one that works. I was interested by, for example, if you look at the Levada polls on attitudes to America. Now, from the sort of the sudden pulse of anti-Americanism in 2014, we've actually seen anti-Americanism decline steadily in Russia until...
Still relatively high.
Well, it's relatively high, but nonetheless, I mean, I think one has to think of these in relative terms. But nonetheless, we have once again seen of late, in the most recent one, an uptick again. So, I mean, I think all of these, this rather sort of tired old set of strategies are once again being brought out. And this is why we'll then see probably a whole variety of local initiatives. You know, it's Krasnoyarsk schools playing that card. Who knows what we'll see next? But I think, again, the message has been set. The line is clear. And all the good little Putinists around the country will now be scurrying to respond.
Now, do you think this is like focused on the election? Is this all about the election and creating this fortress Russia mentality, or something broader going on? Because I think I might see something a little bit broader going on.
Well, we might be seeing something broader, but in a way, I mean, anyway, the election is the clear hurdle that they have to surmount. Mm-hmm. Now, I suspect that in part, depending on how effective this campaign is, they'll then decide for finally whether or not this is just simply, it was an election campaign. Now that they've got that god-awful, tedious bit of pseudo-democracy out the way, they can ignore it, or whether actually, you know, it once again becomes more clearly part of the central narrative, which it always, you know, it's never really gone away. So I think this is it. I mean, in a way, the election, if one of the things that the election is an election, on the other hand, it is an audition for this particular narrative.
Now, I want to add a couple of other things we've seen. You mentioned the media laws and even restricting Western newspapers. There was also reports of an attempt or a proposal to create something of a BRICS internet. And you also saw a Federation Council study warning of Western efforts to turn the youth against the regime. You saw accusations that sanctions were an effort to turn the business elite against Putin. Now, I see something a little broader going on here in this sense. The election, first of all, there's reports in the press this week that Putin effectively wants a short, quiet election campaign, basically. That's what. And but what's more important is what happens after the election. Because after, I'm seeing this election as a watershed towards a new politics in Russia, effectively. Because a series of negotiations are going to start after this election. The consensus is already building in Moscow that this is Putin's last election. The Kremlin's even putting out signals to that effect. And you're beginning to have talk about a constitutional reform to keep Putin in power after the election in some other, after his term is up in 2024 in some other capacity. But as Gleb Pavlovsky pointed out in a really fascinating piece on the Moscow Carnegie website this past week, the negotiations are going to be starting after 2018 about the future of the Russian political system. But they're not, as Pavlovsky put it, just about one tired old man. And they're not just about his innermost circle. The arrangements that are going to be made are going to be made about the whole redistribution of power, assets, authority, and everything within the elite and indeed the society. I mean, this is going to be big, what they're negotiating after 2018. And if this, I'm wondering if this whole fortress Russia trend we're seeing now is an effort to wall Russia off as these very important negotiations are set to begin next year.
Well, I mean, my one specific quibble that I would have with Gleb Pavlovsky's estimate is actually the idea that it'll wait until after the election. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we are already seeing these discussions underway.
Started.
Now, in terms of walling Russia off, look, it cannot wall itself off. There is no way it can do so. In some ways, I tend to think that this notion of noting the risk that the West is trying to basically take the business elite and turn them against Putin. I'm not sure how far that is, shall we say, a Kremlin line, and that is actually part of the very negotiations. Because this is one of the interesting and also problematic things for us, is that now we come to a process of absolute, yes, renegotiation within the elite.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a vast amount of messaging that will be taking place through channels that we don't really know exactly who is behind them. So one of our jobs as analysts outside the system will be trying to unpick what comes from Putin, what comes from the Kremlin, which is a wider thing, what comes from Putin's friends, but also what comes from other elements within it.
Well, this is actually where I wanted to go with this, because, I actually found Pavlovsky's piece really fascinating and really insightful. And a couple of the other points that came out of this was he said there isn't really a lot of direction in the system right now. There's a lot of incoherence. And the reason for this is that we're seeing a divergence between Putin and the collective Putin, essentially. The system is trying to preserve itself. The Putin system is trying to preserve itself. And Putin, the man, has become almost superfluous to this. Now, Putin himself is going to have opinions about that. And as you said, he's not a lame duck. He's a lame, what did you call it, two-headed eagle with long talons or something like that. I can't do it as eloquently as you did, but it was something along those lines. So Putin's going to have something to say about this. So we're going to see this divergence in this sense, which does either A, makes this Fortress Russia part of the discussion, because there are parts of the elite that would like the outside world to be part of this negotiation process that is beginning about post-Putin Russia. And there are those that would not. So I guess what would you say to that? Do we in fact see a divergence between Putin and the collective Putin?
Well, to me, this very much goes back to my earlier take about the three Russias. You know, there is the sort of the practical, just running the country Russia, there is the kleptocratic Russia, and then there is the ideological Russia, mm-hmm. which is really sort of very much associated with current term Putin and a handful of his closest cronies and so forth. And so, yes, I think this is in part exactly a divergence between the two. And precisely the kleptocratic Russia not only does not want to be isolated from the rest of the world, it cannot be. But clearly, when you talk about Western influence, that is an attempt to delegitimize the views of these kleptocrats who actually believe in a much more pragmatic relationship with the outside world. What to me is interesting is, and this is something we haven't yet seen, is if we're seeing this struggle between Putin, who still has his worldview, his self-image of, you know, making Russia great again, and others who are much more pragmatic, where do the uber kleptocrats close to Putin, the Timchenkos, the Rotenbergs, where do they fall? Because at the moment, they're clearly very much associated with the body, with the boss. And that's where
and
they...
the body.
That's where they get their resources or whatever. But in the long term, ultimately, are they sort of willing to cleave absolutely to the ideological model, or are they willing to actually be much more pragmatic and say it's all about the money?
Well, I would say your three Russias, and I would actually say the ideological and the kleptocratic are the more important ones that are fighting with each other. I think these are all present within Putin himself. And so I think your Timchenkos and your Rotenbergs are in our minds associated with the kleptocratic Russia, but they serve the ideological Russia as well. And this is one of the reasons why they are often, they more than others tend to stay in favor with Putin. They're not officials trying to monetize their positions. They will give something back to ideological Russia when asked.
True, but again, I think the question is, it's going to become harder and harder to remain in both camps, I feel.
Mm.
Because I think it's highly unlikely that the elite, the wider elite, are going to want to see a true continuation of this ideological, ultra-nationalist, confrontational, and frankly, highly destructive policy of basically sacrificing everything in the name of trying to build an implausible great power status for Russia today.
Now, moving on to something else, you noted the decrease in anti-Americanism, and I wanted to talk a bit about what all... Well, first of all, I mean, if what you just said is true, actually, you just made me think of this, Is all this fortress Russia rhetoric and action we're seeing now maybe the last gasp of this? Is this kind of a desperate?
I would love to feel it was the last gasp. I mean, it's always dangerous. It's like writing Putin off. It's one of these things. It's always dangerous. But I mean, I think in general terms, whether or not there is going to be yet another pulse, and in part, obviously, it depends on what America does and what America is perceived to be doing. But I think in general terms, yes, we are seeing that, as it were, Putin. To me, Putin reflects the kind of the overarching last gasp, if I can mix my metaphors in a terribly ugly way, of this particularly toxic, zero-sum, where did our empire go, who stole it from us form of nationalism, infused also with all the worst elements of Homo Sovieticus. So, I mean, I think that is absolutely dying. Now, it's not that I think necessarily Russians are going to come to think of Americans as their greatest buddies, but I think what we will see in over time is precisely a normalization. Countries can dislike other countries without feeling that they are somehow implacable enemies. I mean, at the moment, the issue is not so much what you think of America, but how far you believe that America genuinely is trying to destroy your country and, mm-hmm. and its systems. And that's clearly the Kremlin's angle. And I think in this respect, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, in some ways, Russia is not totally wrong when it talks about this terrible Western Gibridnaya Voyna strategy against it. Of course, the West is seeking, through whatever means it can, to support certain strands of opinion. We happen to believe in corruption being a bad thing and therefore anti-corruption being a good thing, on the whole.
Yeah, well, we don't see that as nefarious either. That's just what we are.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it has to be said that we are, you might say, we have different levels of enthusiasm for example, competing against authoritarianism, kleptocracy and so forth, depending on the country. But I mean, generally speaking, however imperfect, we do have a genuine value-based foreign policy. Mm. And the trouble is that actually, therefore, so many of the things that are expressions of our values are, of course, destabilizing and subversive to an essentially authoritarian, corrupt kleptocracy.
Well, yeah, but what you're just describing now is we have these two systems in the world that are basically incompatible with each other. We have one for, despite its faults, based on transparency and the rule of law, and one which is largely based on cronyism, corruption, and patron-client relationships. And that the West, I mean, I've always said Russia's not threatened by what the West is doing, it's threatened by what the West is.
True, but since we do rightly seek to actually assert and express those views and believe that these are values that are precisely international and not national. You know, inevitably, some of the things we do are indeed subversive to the current system. Now, look, that is not me saying, so we shouldn't be doing it. I think we just should be appreciating the extent to which there is a certain tragic inevitability about what is playing out at the moment. We cannot be anything other than we are, what we are. And frankly, I think we've reached a stage where Putin cannot be anything other than what he is.
But Russia could be something other
exactly.
than
exactly. In a way, that is where the real struggle is. The real struggle is, to put it in overdramatic terms, for the soul of Russia. Now, I don't think Russia is imminently going to become a law-based, transparent, democratic state. We can just look at what's happening in Eastern and Central Europe to see how often it's a two steps forward, 1.9 steps back process. But it happens. And I think this is, you know, if you go back to this business of whether this is a kind of a last gasp, I think this precisely reflects the extent to which a certain model is beginning to feel itself being eclipsed. And rather than just thinking that this is the sort of the natural flow of what's going on, it's much better to think of it as the nefarious activities of deliberate
right.
destabilization by other powers.
I can't help but recall that I did this on the Daily Vertical this morning, but Dmitry Medvedev just signed a couple of decrees allowing state corporations, the defense ministry, the FSB, and the Foreign Intelligence Service to not report their procurement data. And the reason for this, according to the report in Vedomosti, was that they don't want to be transparent about how they're circumventing sanctions. So effectively, Medvedev just made what was already one of the most corrupt systems in the world even more corrupt in an attempt to avert sanctions.
And this is this is such a classic Russian move that you do something in the name of security and in the name of advancing the interests of the state, which in practice is going to mean that your institutions will rip that state off all the
right.
more effectively.
Yeah.
And in the process, I mean, let's face it, the greatest individual threat to the Russian state and Russian security is not NATO. It is not anything like that. It is, in fact, embezzlement, corruption, and the delegitimization from within.
But at the same time, that corruption and embezzlement is used as a weapon. So it's effectively a double-edged sword. I think you're correct about that in the long run, but in the short run, that's being used as
a weapon. Sure, exactly. And if you take that message, that image, sure, they have just sort of every now and then they manage to make a non-debilitating stroke against the enemy, but meanwhile they're bleeding.
Mm. Now, I wanted to segue into when your comment about the decline in anti-Americanism that the Levada polls are showing, relative decline. With all of this rhetoric, all this Fortress Russia rhetoric in this environment, I mean, what does this say about the mindset of Russians today? How susceptible are they to this? How malleable are they? Could we see a shift in public opinion on this? The Kremlin's been very skillful at managing public opinion up until now. I don't think that skill is absolute. What are your thoughts on that? Could we see a shift in will the public continue to be susceptible to these kinds of, for lack of a better term, scare tactics?
I think publics generally tend to be quite susceptible to scare tactics. One can look at many Western examples of policies that relate to that, Brexit. but at the same time, we should look at the fundamentals. I mean, if you look at the sort of the broader issues of what do the Russian public say about their satisfaction with their government, for example, I mean, it is clear that there is not a particular correlation. You can manage to combine being unhappy with many of the aspects of your day-to-day life with believing that some foreigners somewhere else actually are unpleasant and don't like you and so forth. And I think this is the thing. In some ways, what the Kremlin is good at is precisely overlaying this foreign enemy. Now, what that does, though, is it does not fix the underlying malaise. It distracts. And okay, that up to a point, that has worked.
What I used to call the Crimea drug.
Well, yeah, but anyway, Crimea actually...
I mean, Crimea being a metaphor for this whole...
The thing about Crimea was, look, however much we may not like the idea, for the overwhelming majority of Russians, that was a very good thing.
Right, but I'm not talking about Crimea in specifically. I'm talking about it as a metaphor for
the
entire...
So that's in some ways, that is, again, in their own terms of reference, a genuine good. Anti-Americanism, and also, I mean, attempt to portray the European Union as this kind of debauched union of the immoral. It can have certain short-term things about just simply saying, so however bad things are, actually, it could be a lot worse and we have to hold up our guard. Whereas Crimea actually was an attempt to, actually had some effect in making people think, oh, well, things are good, actually. So I think this is it. It's how far can you go? Particularly in the fact of, look, ultimately, Russia needs a relationship with the West. If Russia wants to wall itself off, it can, and it will suffer vastly more than we will. And so I think, I think there is a limit to how far you can continue playing the same tactic. And I think it's interesting that although we see anti-Americanism just recently sort of spiking a little bit, if you cannot convert that into genuine support for your own policies, then I think that's when it's the real marker of how far society is beginning to become not inoculated against it, but a little bit blasé.
Mm. We're certainly heading for an eventful couple of years as this negotiating process continues among the Russian elite and between the Russian elite and the Russian society, because I think that's also going to be a part of it. And on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and move from Fortress Russia to Fortress Chechnya and look at some comments from Ramzan Kadyrov that raised a few eyebrows. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vorty, Russia's Super Mafia. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Это моя мечта.
Я считаю, что пришло время
сделать изменения и быть руководителем региона и нести ответственность перед народом. Это очень сложно.
Ramzan Kadyrov's interview with Channel One last weekend was a bit odd, and yes, I know that's a high bar. And it wasn't just odd because it was conducted on horseback. Just months after winning re-election with a stunning 98% of the vote, the mercurial Chechen leader now says it's his dream to step down and retire. Both, Mark, we both commented on this over the past week, and we both seem to agree that this is little more than a game of extortion, since the Kremlin fears that Chechnya without Kadyrov could descend into chaos. So Kadyrov wants something. What do you think he wants?
Well, the usual issue on which he decides to sort of throw his weight around is precisely money. That's what it all comes down to. He needs the money for, well, obviously his own zoo and supercars and everything else. He needs it for his prestige projects, but he also needs it, you know, precisely to buy off the Chechen elite. This is sort of the nature of, like any good sort of, you know, pseudo-criminal feudalism. It requires resources to keep everyone happy. And it's certainly true that at the moment there are once again more and more pressures on the federal budget, which we've got to remember, I mean, basically subsidies account for more than 80% of Chechnya's budget, and frankly more than that, because I think there's a lot of the remaining 20%, which is in effect feather bedding through other sources. But the point is, we now have, there was actually a really interesting piece by Andrei Pertsov at, again, Carnegie Moscow Center, which is basically we seem to be running a lengthy commercial for today, on precisely how more and more provincial leaders are actually getting rather more outspoken in trying to argue their case for resources. So, I mean, you know, it might be that once again feeling the need to reassert the importance of keeping the money coming in, he thought it was time for this. However, I also wonder if Kadyrov is also, just as we have, responding to the overwhelming perception that, in fact, Putin is not going imminently, but nonetheless, we are in the negotiation for the post-Putin order. And maybe his point is to make, look, this is not just about my relationship with Putin. It's actually that if the Kremlin does not want to have another war in Chechnya, then whoever is going to be in power, they need to deal with me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. When I was reading your piece, it kind of clicked on this, because, I mean, I initially was of the mind, yeah, he just wants more money. But you're correct, because I put this in the same category as I put the Sechen-Ulyukayev business and this trial going on. Everybody is preparing and positioning themselves for life after Putin, I think. And I think that's certainly what we're seeing here. Again, it's this notion, again, that the collective Putin and the Putin the man are becoming estranged from each other. And the lifespan of the former is probably going to be longer than the lifespan of the latter, right?
Yeah, and this fits into a pattern that we've seen with Kadyrov, who obviously is periodically willful and even murderously so. But nonetheless, you know, quite recently he has been cropping up a lot more. He was advocating for the burial of Lenin's body. He interestingly enough has really been pushing on policy towards Burma in terms of support of the Rohingyas.
He wants to return Stalin's body to Georgia, if I'm not mistaken.
Quite, probably by plane. And also, I mean, he has been pushing a prohibition campaign inside Georgia, which again runs counter to federal law. So I think, you know, in many ways he's challenging. At the same time, though, he has been demonstrating that he can be useful, and not just in the sense of keeping Chechnya quiet. You know, we saw Chechen Kadyrovtsi military police in Syria as one of the first sort of waves of additional forces.
And there were reports that they participated in the coup attempt in Montenegro.
Absolutely, again, flows of money and so forth. So, I mean, I think in his own way, I mean, what Kadyrov is doing is precisely laying out both the I can be useful in these ways. I, you know, however boorish and uncouth I appear, and frankly am, nonetheless, I'm someone with whom you can make deals. These are the sorts of things I can do for you. But more to the point, do appreciate the extent to which I am already fairly autonomous. And if you want to do something about it, it's not going to be pretty. I mean, I think I'm minded that, and these are sorts of figures that have been rattled around for a while, but certainly from a National Guard report, that, you know, if Chechnya goes, one can expect that will spread to a wider conflagration in the North Caucasus. Because actually, Chechnya at the moment is perversely the calmest of the North Caucasus republics. I mean, it is the calm of the prison cell, but nonetheless the calmest. And this report was suggesting that 100,000 National Guard and 50,000 troops would be needed to pacify it. Now, that's
That's interesting, that's because considering who the head of the National Guard is, Viktor Zolotov.
Exactly.
Closest ally of Kadyrov in Moscow. And that report certainly fits the narrative that Kadyrov would want to be spreading in Moscow at this time, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think in all of these terms, it is Kadyrov being part of these negotiation processes, not so much as someone who's trying to, I think, reshape the post-Putin order within Russia.
He's trying to preserve himself.
So much as to try and ensure that whatever happens in terms of the discussions in Moscow, whoever comes out, whatever kind of system, he himself is protected.
So, I mean, you could say almost that he's panicking, because without Putin, I mean, I guess, does Kadyrov have a future in a post-Putin Russia?
Unfortunately, I think he does. I would be delighted to be proven wrong. So if there's any post-Putinites listening, do prove me wrong. Well, I'll buy you a drink. But I think the thing is that so long as there is this perception, whether or not it's true, and I suspect it's not, but that doesn't really matter. So long as there is this perception that only Kadyrov can keep Chechnya quiet, then frankly, it's in anyone's interests to just turn a blind eye, maybe slightly kind of revise the terms of the deal to, like, you know, you don't gun people down in Moscow. But
and he's been so good at keeping those terms of the deal. And,
well, but I mean, again, I think he's known that he can get away with it. But actually, when it comes to Chechnya, I don't think anyone has any appetite for doing anything about what's going on down there.
No, of course, I don't know, but I will provide that counterpoint for you, and maybe you can buy me a drink when I'm done. You yourself have said, and I agree with you, that this perception in this Kremlin that only Kadyrov can keep Chechnya under wraps is mistaken, that they easily could find another figure who they could buy off sufficiently, who would be less troublesome than Kadyrov, and take care of this problem. So perhaps a post-Putin Kremlin would have a different view of this. But then I would add another point to this. Just this morning, I read a fascinating piece by Vladislav Inozentsev in snob.ru, looking at clues from history as to what will happen post-Putin. And Inozentsev makes the argument that we need to look two places primarily, China after the death of Mao, and not surprisingly, Russia after the death of Stalin. Necessary disclaimers, Putin is not Mao, Putin is not Stalin, but the system is very centralized under him as it was in China under Mao and the Soviet Union under Putin. What was the first thing that happened in each of those cases, Inozentsev argues? Well, in China, in both cases, the first thing that happened was that the most threatening, aggressive figure or figures from the old regime were quickly eliminated. In China, we're talking about the Gang of Four, of course, and in the Soviet Union, we're talking about Levente Beria, right? I think that Kadyrov would probably be one of the people that might fit into that category.
I'm not sure. Look, two reasons. Well, first of all, about this question of the Kremlin regarding Kadyrov as irreplaceable. Sadly, it's broader than that. I mean, I've encountered that similar view amongst, you know, military personnel, amongst people in the national security establishment, you know, even some folks who basically loathe Kadyrov. And again, would be delighted to see him go. But nonetheless, it's actually, I think, a very widespread mesmerization with Kadyrov. But in terms of him being a threat, I mean, I think the thing is that what we have to realize is really he has no traction outside Chechnya except that traction which he's allowed to have. You know, he is big in Chechnya. He has no real mandate as well. If you look at someone like Beria, I mean, Beria was making a not implausible bid to take power.
Yes.
He had the forces, you know, when he was arrested already, at that point, the so-called wild divisions were moving towards Moscow. And it was actually the intervention of the army that specifically sort of blocked that. And even then, there were some skirmishes and some firefights and so forth. Now, Kadyrov is not in a position to take Moscow.
No,
or
he's got
like
a lot
that.
Of men under arms.
He has what? Maybe 40,000 if you include the police and so forth. Now, okay, that's a lot of people. But
and he's aligned with Zolotov, who has the National Guard.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not a disclaimer. I'm not sure if I believe this, but I'm playing devil's advocate.
We are not going to see Kadyrov or, in my opinion, Zolotov sort of as kingmakers, let alone kings. No, but I think
we're talking about perceptions here.
You had to get rid of Beria if you were anyone other than Beria. You do not have to get rid of Kadyrov, especially because, let's be honest, if you want to have the chance of pacifying Chechnya without Kadyrov, odds are you will at least have to be spending as much money on subsidies, and quite possibly more.
But without dealing with a madman.
Well, he's a madman, but he's not an entirely irrational madman. I mean, far be it from me from defending him.
I'm making you defend Kadyrov.
I know, exactly. Thank you so much, Brian.
And I'm playing devil's advocate here.
No, exactly.
I tend to agree with you, but Kadyrov
is manageable. He has increasingly pushed the envelope because he's got away with things. I think it will be relatively easy to push back and make it clear to him that there is a sort of a different etiquette must now apply. I mean, unfortunately...
And you think he's savvy enough to play ball with that?
Well, I think that, let me put it so, whoever takes over will be so desperate to not have a conflict in the Caucasus, they will at least give that a try. Now, it might be that 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, it becomes clear that he's not, and maybe at that point they will also feel more confident and comfortable, especially if, for example, they have managed to pull out of the Donbass or similar. So, in a way, they have some spare troops lying around. But at the moment, I think the idea that, along with everything else that whoever takes over currently would inherit... they'd also be thinking about the possibility of conflagration in the North Caucasus. I really don't see that. I think they just rather would just buy him off and hope that works.
Now, moving aside from Kadyrov to a degree as we bump up towards the end here, I mean, looking at Inozemtsev's scheme of how things look, if we agree that the post-Stalin or the post-Mao model is a fairly decent model, and not just getting rid of the most aggressive and dangerous person, but also what happened after that, this idea of consensus leadership, a weak leader that's acceptable to everybody, collective leadership and so on, no more Mao's, no more Stalin's, and in this case, no more Putin's. Who would be the figures that might be the odd man out in this situation? Who are the Berias and the gangs of four in this?
Well, I mean, I think we'll be looking at people like Zolotov, precisely, who are very much associated with the Ancien Regime and haven't yet demonstrated that they can outgrow that. Now, in some ways, again, because we're not talking about something that's going to happen in weeks, months, or maybe
years. No, we're
talking
years.
It'll be interesting to see whether or not Zolotov kind of moves into the elite more broadly, or whether he remains something of an outsider figure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, either Zolotov will have to be in some ways incorporated or else removed. Or the National Guard. I mean, it doesn't actually have to be just him. I mean, they might decide the National Guard has to move back into the Interior Ministry or something like that. He is the obvious one. Because other figures that otherwise, one might regard as not having any kind of clear role, the Bastrykins of this world, they're just not important enough.
Sechin,
now that's the other big question is precisely, do you essentially try and buy consensus by telling all these people that, who are rich and powerful, that they will continue to be rich and powerful? Or do you identify a few individuals who will have to go? I wouldn't be surprised if Sechin was one of the...
the Hodorkovsky.
Well, yeah, exactly. For two reasons. One is... well, actually, three reasons. One is because he's a high-profile figure who's a useful one to pick for an example. Secondly, nobody really likes him.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, get rid of Sechin, and all of a sudden you also have the opportunity to reapportion lots and lots of resources, which is always one of the good things. We might well see, and frankly, it would probably make a lot of economic sense too, Rosneft, its empire being broken up. But if, at the very least, we would see many of the sort of its additional incorporations once again set free. And that's a way, you get rid of a nasty individual, and you also buy off a lot of other people by giving them the chance, or even just the hope, that they will be involved in the reapportionment of resources. Likewise, I mean, Timchenko would be a possibility, because his role is now that much less politically, now that sort of... sanctions is increasingly closing down avenues for questionable transfers of resources and money, and potentially the Rotenbergs. I think that the Rotenbergs are probably of this very inner circle, probably safer. I think they're more likely to be sort of bought off in some ways or allowed to buy themselves a degree of security by perhaps giving up some of their current perks.
I mean, one has to wonder if these businessmen, your Kovalchuks, your Rotenbergs, your Timchenkos, who are close to Putin, the man, close to the body, if you will, and if there will be kind of a split between them and the rest of the elite who are in official positions. You have to wonder how that's going to play out. Your singling out of Zolotov is interesting because by diminishing Zolotov, you basically deprive Kadyrov of any Krisha he might have in Moscow. Other than Surkov, who's not really a Krisha, more of an ally. But anything to add before you wrap it up for the week?
No, I mean, I think except just to the extent to which, I mean, Kadyrov, as ever, is illustrating the wider policies at work.
Yeah.
And in some ways, what I think, it's not surprising that Kadyrov does this, because Kadyrov is always doing this in one form or other. What I think is going to be really interesting is at what point do we start seeing other figures within the elite, whether they're regional bosses, including people like Sobyanin, or institutional bosses also beginning to throw their weight around and present themselves as people demanding not just, I need more money for my ministry or whatever, but I need to have a voice in the post-Putin order, because that's really what we're seeing. It's a question of, anyway, who gets to actually draw up the Magna Carta?
Right. No, and this is going to be interesting. It's going to be a long, drawn-out process because, like you said, Putin's not going anywhere tomorrow. But the consensus in Moscow is this is his last campaign. This is his last term as president. He's going to move possibly into some Russian Ayatollah, Deng Xiaoping, head of the state council type role after that. But you're going to see changes in the nature of the system. And even that is only putting off the inevitable. Sooner or later, the man's going to pass. And this negotiation is going to be going on for this entire six-year presidential term. If you think of past periods when the Russian elite was negotiating with itself, and that I use that term very, very broadly, because if you think of the negotiations that we saw in 1998, 1999, they were pretty pretty volatile and destabilizing. That took place over a period of a year or so.
But I think I don't think this will draw out necessarily. I think what we might well see is a point where precisely once there is a critical mass achieved that says, well, okay, we think we have a vision of the future, and it is one that Putin can live with, I think that at that point we will actually see the change happening. I don't think they're all going to sit there thinking, well, we pretty much agreed, but we've still got 3 years for this to play out.
Right.
Or similar. I'm still, if I had to put money on it, I would still say that Putin is not going to spend the next 6 years after 2018 in the presidency.
Really? You would say he's going to leave before the end of the next term?
I think so.
I would possibly agree with that. I mean, I think there's a series of things that have to be negotiated here. It's the collective Putin and Putin. It's the collective Putin and society, because I would not leave society out of this. Society's getting restless, and the Navalny phenomenon, not necessarily Navalny the man, but the Navalny phenomenon is going to be a factor in this. So you're going to have something the elite can live with, but that they can also sell to society, and the society can live with as well. So this could draw out. I would maybe think that how long Putin remains as president is going to be determined by how long these negotiations
play out.
So, Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up today. That's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Thank you for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week when I will do a special on-the-road edition of the podcast from Tbilisi, Georgia, where I will be participating in the Tbilisi strategic discussions. Until then, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.